the problems with a lot of these triggers is the fact that extremes of the triggers tend to bring on, extremes of exposure tend to bring on headaches. In fact, there was a very interesting study that was published by Tim Hool just about in the last year, where they looked at something called surprisal. What that means is that how different is your exposure to the trigger compared to what it normally is. So let's say you drink 2 cups of coffee per day, but tomorrow you drink 4. That's a 2-cup difference compared to your norm. Surprise. So those people are more likely to develop headaches.
Ever feel like the nasty storm on the horizon is about to set off a worse one in your head? Or you've taken a bite of Mushu pork and then panic about whether it's laced with migraine-triggering MSG? We've all been taught certain truths about triggers that researchers are beginning to challenge with new evidence. Whether it's weather, food, hormones, exertion, stress, certain medications, or sensory overload, it's time to separate the facts about migraine triggers from the fiction. Dr. Vince Martin is the director of the Headache and Facial Pain Center at the University of Cincinnati Gardner Neuroscience Institute. He has been the professor of clinical medicine in the Division of Internal Medicine since 2004. Dr. Martin is the president of the National Headache Foundation, as well as the Ohio Headache Association. And he's been a fellow of the American Headache Society and the American College of Physicians, and is on the leading authority on weather and migraine. Dr. Martin, welcome back to the Migraine World Summit.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Terrific. Well, first, let's address the growing confusion between symptoms and triggers. Can you separate the two for us?
Well, the problem that we run into with migraine triggers is the fact that there's something called the migraine prodrome. And the migraine prodrome actually occurs before the onset of headache. And with the prodrome, there are a variety of different symptoms that patients can experience. They include things like food cravings and intense fatigue and sensitivity to light, noise, and even neck pain. So that precedes the headache phase. So sometimes what can happen is people may misconstrue those symptoms as migraine triggers. Now, migraine triggers are defined as any factor that upon exposure or withdrawal will provoke a headache. So there probably are some instances where triggers are true triggers, and there probably are some instances where patients misconstrue these prodromal symptoms as triggers.
Like a neck pain can be one of those where you don't know if it's a symptom or a trigger.
I think sometimes they probably go both ways. Mm-hmm. So if you have a migraine attack and if the neck pain is just short-lived right before the migraine, it's probably a prodromal symptom. On the other hand, if you've had a neck injury and you've had continuous pain for like 2 or 3 weeks, and all of a sudden you've noticed your headaches to get worse, it's probably a trigger.
So let's talk about the timing of these triggers. How far in advance did the exposure to the trigger then turn into the migraine attack?
Well, in most cases, from time to exposure to the onset of the attack is going to be less than 24 hours. And in some cases, it may actually be anywhere from a few minutes to 3 hours. Most of the triggers are probably going to happen within a short period of time. But there are some rare instances where there could be a delay in a trigger for 24 hours, or the effect of a trigger may be maximal on day one, but if it doesn't cause the headache on day one, it may get you on day two. So there can be a little bit of a delay in onset of trigger to onset of the headache.
I was looking at your research, and some were as short as 13 minutes and others by 24 hours.
Yes.
Do you recall which ones were faster versus longer acting?
Well, some of them, like light, for example, tends to be a shorter time period between that and the trigger. Some exercise may be a little bit longer in some instances. So it kind of depends on the trigger, but I don't know that we know for certain yet that this trigger has a shorter period of time from onset of the trigger to onset of the headache than, say, another trigger factor.
So several authors have talked about this concept of a migraine threshold being surpassed. What do we know in terms of the research that's behind that migraine threshold?
Well, I think that the concept that I would like to get to all the people in the audience is that your susceptibility to a trigger may vary from day to day. So your threshold may vary. And that's because neurologically, we're not really the same from one moment to the next. And there probably are certain environmental factors that sensitize the trigeminal system, which is the main system involved in migraine, that set that threshold either up or down. So if, say, for example, maybe if you're overusing triptans, for example, like medications like sumatriptan, or the trade name for that is Imitrex, and you're doing that on a daily basis for a long period of time, there's some animal data to suggest that that sensitizes the system. And then if you're exposed to something like a light stimulus later on, all of a sudden that'll trigger a migraine. So there may be a two-hit phenomenon here. Since first sensitization of the system that's involved in migraine, followed by another stimulus that wouldn't normally trigger a headache, all of a sudden it does. It's like the threshold has been lowered, and all of a sudden that stimulus causes a migraine.
So does that explain why we can be sensitive to a trigger on one day and not sensitive on another?
Yes. In fact, if you look at experimental studies where they've looked at trigger factors for migraine, what they find is, depending on the trigger and depending on the individual, it may only have a 10 or 20 or even 30% chance of causing a migraine. That's because your nervous system may be more vulnerable at time point A than time point B.
I find that there are some days that it's not wise to drink wine, for example, because I'm sensitive in several other areas. And other days where I feel like, okay, it's a safe day. I can consume this now.
Well, I think there's a couple of trigger factors in particular that probably set the stage and people who are susceptible to them. One are hormonal triggers. If you think about, if you have what's called menstrual migraine, which occurs anywhere from 2 days before to 2 days after menstruation, that's a time where you have declining and low estrogen levels. So there can be like a 3 or 4 day or maybe even 5 day time period where your brain is exposed to those low levels of estrogen, and that can make you very vulnerable to other triggers like, say, a glass of wine or some other trigger factor. The other one, I think, is weather. And there is some controversy in terms of what effect weather has on headache, although I'll tell you that from some of the research we've done, there is really little doubt that weather can trigger headache in susceptible people, and it may be more prominent in some areas than others. But when you say have a low pressure system that comes in, what you get is falling and declining barometric pressure, and you get a variety of other meteorologic factors like precipitation and humidity that can influence things as well. There could be 3 to 5 day time period, you know, where that low pressure system just kind of hangs. You know, if you watch weather maps, the big L is sitting there and it's not moving. It's right close to your location. And that can be a trigger that can be persistent and make you more vulnerable during that time of having a migraine if you're exposed to another trigger.
Is the concept of triggers being additive something that is evidence-based?
There's not a lot of data. There was one study where they found that, this was a study by Seymour Diamond, this is probably about 20 years ago, where they looked at alcohol intake and stress, and they found that if those two occurred on the same day, that there was an increased likelihood of having a migraine. But if stress occurred just by itself, there was no increased risk. So there probably is some additive effect, although there's not a lot of data in that regard.
So in your research, you identified some triggers that can actually help predict a migraine attack. Can you talk about which ones and how that works?
Well, the two that I've done research on myself is hormones, and we found that if the estrogen levels were both low and falling around the menstrual period, that was a very high predictive time period, and weather. And what we found with weather was that in patients that had low and falling, if the barometric pressure was low and falling both together, you kind of talk about additive effects. Uh-huh. That was a very high-risk time period, but only for certain individuals. It was certain people were sensitive to that. But then there was another subgroup that responded to the exact opposite, which is high and rising. So those are people that are responding to an approaching high-pressure system. And what we found was, if you responded to high and rising, that actually low and falling was preventative, and vice versa.
Wow.
So, and the problems with a lot of these triggers is the fact that extremes of the triggers tend to bring on, extremes of exposure tend to bring on headaches. In fact, there was a very interesting study that was published by Tim Hool just about in the last year, where they looked at something called surprisal. What that means is that how different is your exposure to the trigger compared to what it normally is. So let's say you drink 2 cups of coffee per day, but tomorrow you drink 4. That's a 2-cup difference compared to your norm. Surprise. So those people are more likely to develop headaches. But same token, if you normally drink 2 cups of coffee per day, and tomorrow you only drink 0, those people are also more likely to get headaches. So it's this concept that it's the change from whatever your body is used to. So your body becomes kind of acclimated to a given trigger, and then deviations from that, from your daily pattern, tends to bring on a headache, whether it's in a positive or negative sense.
So this goes back to the concept of the migraine brain loving consistency.
Exactly.
Right, and loving routine. And when we introduce things like travel or vacations, people wonder why they have attacks on the first day of vacation, that letdown effect. What other things bring on rapid change that are unanticipated?
Stress is another example. So stress, interestingly, Richard Lipton published a study where he found that during the letdown period, so if you have a lot of stress today, then you're more likely to have a headache the next day. And it was most prominent during the first 6 hours compared to the next six hours. So there's some sort of a waning of the effect. But there seems to be a little bit of a lag for stress. But also in that surprisal study we talked about, where it's not so much the change from one day to the next, but it's the change from what your baseline is. What they found was that either the change from baseline, either too much stress or too little stress, either of those could trigger a headache.
So let's go back to the things that we can control. Yeah. Which types of triggers do you feel like people have the most control over?
Well, I think it's a matter of learning how to cope with certain types of triggers, like stress, for example. What we can, we may not be able to change the stress, because let's face it, life happens.
It does. Mm-hmm.
But what we can do potentially is change the way we react to the stress. So learning biofeedback, relaxation techniques, exercise, and using all the non-pharmacologic things that we recommend, for example, keeping yourself hydrated, and eating regularly, you know, avoiding prolonged fasting. So there's a variety of different things that we can do to try to prevent headaches the best that we possibly can. Other things like menstrual migraine could theoretically be prevented by preventing the fall in estrogen. So for example, some women who have menstrual migraine, which once again is headaches occurring 2 days before to 2 days after the menstruation, can actually take oral contraceptives at very low doses of estrogen, because sometimes estrogen can actually provoke headaches when given at high levels. So you want to use a low-dose oral contraceptive, and that's given continuously for 3 months. Therefore, there's not the monthly declines like you would see with your native menstrual cycle, and maybe you would either cycle the pill every 3 months or maybe not have any menstrual cycles whatsoever. So there are ways to deal with hormonal triggers to prevent the fall in estrogen, which we think is the primary trigger factor. For other things like weather, it becomes a little bit more difficult because weather is pretty stagnant. But what I would argue is that learning how triggers affect migraine is absolutely essential. Each trigger probably influences that trigeminal system in a different way. And you could develop therapies that work for, you know, low pressure triggered headaches or hormonally triggered headaches or stress triggered headaches. And you may have pharmacologic therapies or drug therapies that can actually interrupt these processes in each situation if you really know what the chemical pathways are that are causing, say, stress to trigger a headache or hormones to trigger a headache. So this is really important research that's being done.
We agree, and this is going to be a must-watch session for sure, basic for everyone to make sure that they see essential. So in your research, you evaluated 4 ways to manage migraine triggers that you called the repetition and avoidance theory. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, the big thing is there are four groups in the one study, but the repetition theory is simply that maybe you don't need to avoid the trigger to get it better, but you actually expose yourself to the trigger. And that was done by Paul Martin, who's not related to me.
Okay.
And it's not me that did that research. But what he did was he looked at light and noise in particular and found that if you have more exposure to either light or noise over a period of time, that if you get more exposure, that there might be a certain threshold above which that the likelihood of a headache is less. So he developed a whole theory of repetition where there might be some migraine triggers in which you want to expose yourself to, in particular light and trigger, maybe noise as well. Light is a trigger and noise. But not all triggers can be managed that way. like a hormonal trigger is going to be a hormonal trigger. I mean, it's going to last as long as the estrogen withdrawal. And I can tell you this, with hormones in particular, we did a study where we actually gave a chemical to basically induce menopause in women who were still menstruating to see what effect it had on headaches. And when you didn't give them any estrogen back, they would have headaches for 3, 4, 5 weeks consecutively. So a continuous exposure to low estrogen states probably does not, the body doesn't acclimate to that. So there probably are some triggers where there's no acclimation. There could be some triggers in which there are. So he recommends learning how to cope with your triggers. So it's like a coping strategy. So first, identifying what are your major triggers, and then he recommends, particularly with light, noise, and so forth, to be exposed to those over time to see if you can kind of desensitize your nervous system. It's almost like allergy shots.
Right.
So it's like getting things in small increments and then gradually building yourself up so you can tolerate, you know, say a bright light at a much higher intensity than before. The other theory is the avoidance theory. And that's the exact opposite, where if you're triggered by red wine, then you should just avoid red wine. And there are not a lot of great studies that have really looked at that per se. But it's also, in some cases, very difficult to do, because particularly if you have a lot of triggers. So if you have like 15, 20, or 40 different triggers, and you're going to try to avoid all those triggers, it just doesn't become practical. There's no, you might have an unhealthy diet if you have a lot of dietary triggers, or so it may not be practical if you have a lot of triggers. But I would say this is, if you have a clear trigger factor, then you probably can deal with it in a number of different ways. Like take exercise for an example. So let's say exercise triggers your headaches. Maybe you can just, you know, exercise to a point where you don't get a headache, and maybe try to build it up over time.
Does light exposure work that way too? You know, we've talked about this topic with Dr. Kathleen Digray, for example, and she said, don't avoid the light, that it's bad to stay in the dark for us. So a little bit of light exposure each day, does the theory go that that can help you help rewire your brain to accept the light?
Well, I think that goes along with what we're talking about with Dr. Paul Martin,
right?
Namely that if you have more exposure to light over time, that may kind of desensitize the nervous system to fire off and create a migraine. So I would never advise people to spend their whole days in a dark room. For one thing is it kind of creates, a belief that maybe you can't do anything. And we want to try to empower people to get out and do things. So I think that that's the wrong strategy for a number of different reasons.
It elevates anxiety too, which is not helpful.
Yeah.
I mean, I know people who don't have migraines who will avoid sweet potatoes because they had one bad experience with sweet potatoes. And that might not be because they're allergic. They might need to try it another time, and different circumstances could apply. So I want to go back and follow up on your point about the number of triggers that any individual person can have. Because I've read some research that says that, you know, some people only have one or two or three, some have four, but very few have more than four.
It depends how you try to define what trigger factors a person has. If you ask them what trigger factors they have, you know, the list is relatively long. But if you ask, if they actually do diary studies and they try to determine statistically which triggers that you have, then most people get down to about 3 to 5 trigger factors that you can statistically prove are actually trigger factors. So I think it depends on how you define that. But there are a lot of triggers that people think they have that are really not true triggers when you actually look at them systematically and try to figure out statistically if they actually do have a higher likelihood of having headache on those days versus when they don't consume that trigger factor.
And in your experience, are there any ways to identify your trigger factors that you think are more effective than others?
Well, there are certain apps that you can get, and the apps can actually, if you record your headache data as well as record a list of trigger factors, and then if you can statistically link those, I think that's probably your strongest evidence that the trigger is actually a trigger in you.
So when we experience triggers that we cannot control, like weather and hormones, I think are the biggest ones people experience, what's the best way to manage those?
Well, I think we talked a little bit about the hormonal thing with the oral contraceptives, or the other strategy sometimes people will use is they can give an estrogen patch during the tail end of the menstrual period when they're about ready to have tail end of the menstrual cycle when they're about ready to have a menstrual period, and they can give that patch for anywhere from about 7 to 10 days, and in some women that will blunt the fallen estrogen and prevent the menstrual migraine. In terms of weather, there are no known ways to deal with that, although what I would say is this is I take care of a number of different people that have another disorder called idiopathic intracranial hypertension, which is where their spinal fluid pressures are high. And those people are exquisitely sensitive, particularly to low pressure systems. I mean, it's amazing. They are really sensitive. And those people anecdotally seem to, their weather sensitivity to low pressure systems, which are systems where there's rain and really bad weather, sometimes thunderstorms, they will respond to water pills, acetazolamide or something called aldactone. So at least in other groups of patients who have weather-triggered headaches, those are the drugs that are used. Whether those drugs are effective in migraine patients, we don't know yet, but that's something that may be studied in the future.
Interesting. So we invited members of our community to submit questions that we could ask you to get really practical. And Sherry Butler asked, what can be done as a preemptive strike to try and prevent migraine with barometric pressure changes?
Well, there are no definitely well-proven therapies for these types of headaches, particularly low-pressure systems where you get rain and thunderstorms and so forth. But in another group of patients where they have high intracranial pressure, so their spinal fluid pressures are high, it's called idiopathic intracranial hypertension, we use a variety of water pills to treat headaches in those people, and they are very sensitive to low-pressure systems. So we use things like acetazolamide and also another one called aldactone, or spironolactone is the generic name for that. So in that group of people, their weather-triggered headaches seem to respond fairly well to water pills. Whether or not migraine patients respond to that with their weather changes is a subject for future research.
Oh, please research that. Hundreds of thousands of people would love to have that answer.
I can tell you that weather is probably, in certain parts of the country, like I live in Cincinnati, probably the number one reported trigger for patients. Now, if you live in another place where, say, barometric pressure is not as big of a, doesn't change as much, like, say, Phoenix, Arizona, or San Diego, it may not be as evident in that place.
Well, they get other triggers. They get a lot of bright sunlight. They get intensely high heat. It's not just barometric pressure, right, in the weather scope.
Exactly. There are many different factors. So we know that humidity and precipitation can trigger headaches. So if you have a low-pressure system that comes in and it's associated with precipitation, that probably confers a higher risk. We also know that bright sunlight is a big trigger for auras in particular, and probably triggers a migraine without aura as well. So that's a big trigger as well. Other environmental factors, which we haven't really talked about, but things like air pollution in some patients can be a trigger as well. So there are many different things in the environment that can trigger headaches.
So I'm going to follow up on that with a question that also came in from our community. Helen asked, how can we manage odor and noise sensitivity in everyday life?
Well, I think that is really about the management of headaches. I think we had talked earlier about this whole concept of avoidance versus repetition. I think that a continual exposure to a trigger, at least in today's world, is very difficult to sell to people. So if you have chronic migraine and I tell you, like, and you're light sensitive, I say, your therapy is to go out in the bright sunlight, they're going to think that you're crazy. So right now, this whole idea of using repetition as a way to manage that trigger probably doesn't work. But there are ways to kind of modify the trigger. So one is if noise is a trigger for you, you could wear noise-canceling headphones. You could wear earplugs. You could talk to your supervisor if it's at work and talk about the loud employee that's talking next to you to maybe get him to kind of calm it down. You could have carpets as opposed to hardwood in your office. There's certain kinds of walls or dividers that are better for noise. So I think it's really really more of kind of managing the trigger in a way. In terms of light, we know that light can trigger headaches in a number of different ways. We know that the brightness of the light can be a problem. So if bright light from a computer screen is a problem, just turn down the brightness on the screen. We also know that flickering lights, like fluorescent lights, the flicker pattern can trigger headaches. So maybe you want to use incandescent bulbs. Get away from the fluorescent light if possible. And then the third thing that light can do is the color of the light. You don't really realize it, but there's a spectrum of colors of light. And we know that blue light is probably the most noxious. Green light is probably the best. So what you could do is you could change the hue or the color of your screen to more of a greenish color as compared to the typical colors. So there's a number of things that you can do, I think, to manage the trigger. And then also preventative therapy. I think that can calm down the nervous system too. So if you get on the right preventative, all of a sudden your triggers may not be quite as prominent. So you might that might be a way to increase your threshold.
Less sensitivity. I avoided HGs for about 15 years, and I lost a lot of life. And now I can eat HGs without triggering. So it is possible, I think, once you get the whole nervous system calmed down to do that. Gwen observed that her sensitivity to smells like perfume and chemicals is so severe that she hardly goes out anymore. Does trigger sensitivity get worse with age?
Well, we don't know the answer to that, but I will give you another example of another disorder where it does. There's a syndrome called non-allergic rhinitis. That's where patients develop like running of their nose, and we've actually done research on that. And it's triggered by a lot of chemicals. You know, it's by things like, you know, weather changes and chemical exposure and perfumes and cigarette smoke, which incidentally are exactly the same triggers that we see in our migraine patients. And these were developed by a different group of patients and by a different group of doctors. So there's probably some similarities there. And in that group of people with non-allergic rhinitis, they tend to get worse as they get older. It's much more likely. So those disorders and research that we've done are probably linked, non-allergic rhinitis and migraine. So there probably is some, you know, biologic basis for that.
We were talking with Dr. Robert Cowan about catastrophizing. And for some people, just going and being exposed to the perfume counter or the, you know, gas station, you can begin to catastrophize in your mind and think that it's going to get worse, which the more you become aware of it, the more you catastrophize and the more you think it's going to trigger something. And so its impact on you might be greater. Does that hold any water?
I think it does. I think there are some people that so hyper-focus on the triggers that the very thought of being around the trigger is enough to increase anxiety, which then might trigger a headache. So there could be instances where you need to learn how to deal with your pre-anticipatory anxiety, mm-hmm. where you're going to be around a trigger. So I think that is another potential mechanism through which triggers could lead to a migraine.
Cool. So real quick, I want to go through some myths about migraine and ask you to declare them true or false, and then briefly explain why. So, first one, everyone's susceptible to every migraine trigger.
That's definitely false. Migraine triggers are individualistic. So probably most people probably have some migraine triggers, whether they recognize them or not. But you're not susceptible to every trigger. So doing things where you avoid every known trigger to migraine is a big mistake and one that's going to really limit your life.
Life on eggshells. Second one, all foods listed as potential migraine triggers should be avoided.
False. We know that there's only certain foods that have actually been proven to be triggers. Like you take MSG, for example, monosodium glutamate, which is a flavor enhancer. That seems to be most potent when consumed in a liquid form as opposed to food. So you might be able to have MSG in food, but if you eat that wonton soup and it's laden with MSG, that all of a sudden might be a trigger for you if you're in a vulnerable time period. So I'll throw that one in.
Hormonal, weather's changing.
As well.
MSG in your soup.
And it's not healthy. I mean, to avoid all dietary triggers is frankly not healthy.
Right. Next one is everyone with migraine is sensitive to weather changes.
No, no migraine patient is sensitive to any trigger factor in isolation. But I would say this is depending on where you live. Like in our study, it looked like about 2/3 of patients had some weather sensitivity in St. Louis, Missouri, in a study that we presented at the American Headache Society about a year ago. So there are some that are very prevalent, And menstrual migraine occurs in about two-thirds of women who are still menstruating. So there's some triggers that are more potent than others and more prevalent than others. So not all trigger factors are created the same.
Not all equal. Okay. How about chocolate? Is it a proven migraine trigger?
No, it's not a proven one, although in some recent diary studies, it does appear that a very small percentage of people, probably 3 to 5% of the time, can be statistically proven to have a headache on days in which they eat chocolate.
So not as big as weather or hormones.
No.
Maybe 90% of the people can try chocolate again.
Yes.
Okay, cool. People with migraine should avoid caffeine. True or false?
I think that that's false. But I would say this, is that once again, with this whole theory of changes from the norm, caffeine is one of those things where if you don't keep a consistent pattern, then you may very well have a headache. So an example, on weekends. So you're normally used to drinking your 2 cups of coffee at 8 a.m. and you decide you're going to sleep in. So you sleep in till 11 a.m. All of a sudden you wake up with a headache. So you've changed things. So you need to keep a consistent pattern. The other thing I would say about caffeine is that if you consume really large quantities of caffeine, like you start getting up to 3, 4, 8 ounce beverages, it can start to have neurologic effects on you. Those people are more likely to be more anxious, they're more likely to be more depressed, and they're more likely to be more irritable. All of these things can trigger headaches. So I think really high doses of caffeine are bad. And we also know from surgical studies, when people are not able to drink their caffeine in the morning, that if you don't have any caffeine, say on a surgical day, that by the afternoon, that you're gonna probably get a headache. And if you're consuming higher doses of caffeine at baseline, and you don't have any caffeine for that surgery, then you're even more likely to have a headache on those days.
Wow. So a red wine is the most common migraine trigger, true or false?
No, I don't think that's true or not. I think that I don't think that we really know for sure, you know, what the prevalence is, although there was one diary study which suggested that red wine and white wine were less than 5% of the people could be statistically proven to have headaches on days when they consume those products.
Well, that's helpful, generally speaking, for all those true false myths. But I want to ask you, do you think that popular media has created a kind of unhealthy trigger anxiety for people?
Well, I think the media has done a lot of different things to society, which we won't talk about. But at any rate, yes, I think that is if you make migraine patients think that every trigger they could be potentially sensitive to, and if they tend to hyper focus on those triggers, in a way you could be doing more harm than good. But by the same token, if you can identify and well establish a trigger as a definite cause for your headaches, in my opinion, avoidance in most cases is a much more practical strategy than trying to expose yourself.
So what kind of research do you think that we need to be doing next about triggers to help us address some of the most common issues that people with migraine are facing?
Well, I think that we need to figure out how each trigger is causing a migraine attack. Because if we can find out which triggers are causing them, we can develop very specific therapies, maybe even drug therapies that will block that. Now, when you have really common triggers, like let's say stress is a real common trigger, maybe there would be a drug in the future that would just block the impact of stress on your migraines. And if you're someone in whom that's driving a large number of your migraines, then that can make a big difference. And there would be different therapies for hormonally triggered headaches and different therapies for weather triggered headaches. And these would augment existing therapies in the headache field.
So it's incredibly individualistic, right? We need to work with our doctors to identify a treatment plan that addresses the specific triggers, is what I'm hearing from you.
Absolutely. When I see a headache patient, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to figure out, all right, what could be triggering their headaches? Is it the neck that's triggering their headaches? Is it the fact that they had some major traumatic life event? Is it the fact that they're depressed? Is it the fact that they have TMJs, they have a problem with their TMJ joint? Or maybe there's some other factor that could be triggering it. So I'm going to try to address those trigger factors along with using conventional preventative therapies and healthy lifestyles in total to try to manage the headache patient.
Okay. So let's get back to the most effective ways to determine our individual triggers. Do you favor paper diaries or do you favor certain apps? And do you have any preferences on the pros and cons of different apps to help determine this?
Well, I think in terms of the apps, and I'm not trying to plug any one app, but I think that the Curalator app is the one that provides the best data and statistical help with in determining whether a trigger is truly a trigger.
Which is now called N1.
Yeah.
Right.
And the other thing would be with paper diaries, I think that they become a little bit problematic to notice an association because a doctor, along with the patient, would need to go through the individual diaries with the person to figure out whether there's an association. It becomes a little bit more difficult. If you have an observant patient, I mean, if a beer, say, causes a headache 80% of the time, it doesn't take, you don't need a paper diary to figure that out. You know, if you're an observant person, you know that you should avoid that trigger.
So is it possible that once we track our triggers and work with our doctors on these specific treatment plans to address those triggers that are very individual, we might be able to enjoy chocolate and a summer thunderstorm without fear?
I would say that probably chocolate you probably can enjoy. The thunderstorm, if you're sensitive to it, that's real biology. And that will probably still produce your headaches.
Okay. Well, this has been fascinating and super helpful. We're really glad that you're here. Where can we learn more about you and follow your work?
Well, there's a couple of ways. One is if you're scientific and you want to read some of the papers that I've published, they could be referenced in something called PubMed. You could read the original publications. And the ones that I'm probably most known for would be weather and hormones and how they trigger headaches. The other thing is that the National Headache Foundation is developing a program called Work Migraine, where there's a trigger factor module where we go through all the triggers, all the data, and what the problem is, the trigger factor, and what the solution is. So that will soon be available to patients to use.
Great. Well, we'll try to add a link to that underneath your talk so people can find it easily.
Great.
Dr. Martin, thank you for being here on the Migraine World Summit.
My pleasure.